Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where our guest today is Alexandra Andrews, author of the debut novel, Who is Maude Dixon? This is a Book Reporter Bets On selection, and I want you to know that I sat down on Saturday, about two Saturdays ago, and read this book for the entire day because it is that terrific. It was a propulsive kind of a read, and really, who is Maude Dixon? And we're going to get into that. So welcome, Alexandra. So nice to have you here. Let's start out by you telling us, who is Maude Dixon and what is this?
Well, I'm going to make you buy the book, so I'm not going to tell you that. But I'll give you a short answer, which is Who is Maude Dixon is about a very ambitious young woman who wants very badly to be a famous writer. And she lands the job as the assistant to a very famous writer who writes under a pseudonym. And one thing leads to another, and she decides that she's going to steal her life.
Yes, and she's going to take every little bit of it. As the book opens, Florence is working for a publisher, ready to make her mark in publishing. And it's funny because I worked at Condé Nast when I first started out, and every assistant sits down at the chair, ready to become the editor. So while I didn't work in publishing, I understand the whole thing. So Maude has written this book called Mississippi Foxtrot, and she wrote it while she was working at a textbook company as a proofreader. So what were you doing when you wrote Maude?
That's a good question. I was not working at a textbook company. I went through so many zigs and zags in my own career. I started out in investigative journalism, which I was terrible at. And then I ended up copywriting for a long time for fashion brands. And then I went and got my master's in graphic design, which was a bit of a boondoggle. And I mean, throughout this whole period, I was basically just copywriting to support myself. So copywriting is what I was doing while I wrote this book.
Writing
so far off from proofreading.
Writing great copy. So you never worked in publishing. You never worked at a publishing house.
I never did, no.
So you just imagined it quite well, because you certainly have nailed what that house was like.
Well, you know, I interned at the Paris Review when I was just out of college. I worked at ProPublica. I've sort of been around the publishing milieu enough. My husband works in publishing, not in book publishing, but in magazine publishing. So I had sort of gotten a feel for it. And, you know, journalism is sort of the same way. You start, you know, it's a bit like an apprenticeship.
Mm-hmm. And you also don't know how many people make the cut after a year. Like a lot of times people are gone within a year because they're going back to Illinois and go, I really don't want to live in New York and do this.
Like, I know. I mean, I'm 37. I still think that. Like, why am I paying this rent?
Why am I doing this? And why am I sitting and doing this?
Yeah.
So I just love at the beginning, Florence has this one night stand with someone in power at the publisher. Okay. And it really undoes her emotionally and her career. But right away, you're sitting there going, is she really innocent here? Because it takes this really dark turn. And it's funny. I went back and looked this morning, and it's really, her career takes a change after page 60 or 62 in the book. It's not that long, but the setup is so good that I really thought it was halfway through the book when this ended up happening. So just tell us, was she really the victim, or did she sort of connive herself around a little?
I think both. I'm glad you said that, actually, because I really wanted to have this feeling where she just felt a little bit off at the beginning, and it really could have gone either way. You know, she could have just been a little quirky, or it could have been something more. And I actually went back and would add a few things or take them away to try to get the right balance. I think she, you know, she's of that age in her early 20s when you're really malleable. You can go either way. And I think part of her was victimized, and I think part of her was conniving. Mm-hmm. And she's sort of figuring out which direction she's going to go in, which you ultimately find out is not the good one.
Not the good one. No. But, you know, I feel like up front we see strains of who she becomes later in the book, and we're going to give nothing away.
I'm trying to be careful. I always give something away.
You're very careful. But I feel like we're seeing her DNA, and I was really interested to see you did go back and finesse her more like later on, because I feel like you had to write her and then really define her even more, like just go back and see what to do. So was that something that did happen along the way?
A little bit of both. It's so hard when you're writing, you don't know what a reader is going to pick up on. You know, I would give this book to people and I wouldn't know whether like all the twists were totally predictable. You can't get that distance as a writer. Mm-hmm. So I think I realized, I thought I had made her like a little bit off enough, but I had some feedback that I should make her like seed in a bit more of these like darker foreshadowing moments.
Yeah, and there's some, right at the beginning, there's some things that she does that are so out of the ordinary, but how she gets away with them at the job too is like pretty amazing. You know, probably the author we wonder about most right now is Elena Ferrante. Like, who is Elena Ferrante? And of course, when Lying Life of Adults came out last fall, everybody was back going, okay, man, woman, da, da, da. Right. Did you think about her when you were creating your Maude Dixon character?
I absolutely did, yes. I find her really fascinating. And I was sort of, when the idea for this book came right at that point where Elena Ferrante fever was really at its pitch. And I loved those books. And I was interested by this fascination with who she really was, which I didn't totally share. I was more of the mind that you can just let these books stand for themselves. And then I found it so sad when that journalist like tracked her down and like went through the payroll at this agency. It seemed so like silly, like, but why? She wants to be anonymous. I don't understand this urge to know who's writing these. I mean, I do understand it a little bit, but I was interested in both the kind of mind that wants to write anonymously and the kind of mind that will not allow that to happen.
Yeah, that's exactly. And you know, with her, whenever we feature her, there is no picture. So there's that air of mystery right mm-hmm. away of, you know, there is a picture. And there are a number of other authors who have written under pseudonyms and they never share their pictures as well. And it's always, who is this? The whole industry starts trying to guess. I mean, you can even think about when Robert Galbraith was actually J.K. Rowling. And people are like, well, will it be a success on its own? Or does it have to have her name attached to it and know who she is?
It come out even before it was published, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. And it was like, well, wait a second, is this going to be a success or does it really need the name attached? And it's just, I think, really, really interesting. So in your book, Maude, we're not going to tell too much more, lives in a sleepy little town upstate New York. She's off the grid. And she has this line that said, he lives well who is well hidden. So let's talk about that line because it's so great. He who lives well is well hidden. I like it. I'd like to hide.
I know. I think there is sort of... I think we all have that impulse to hide. I'm somebody who really does not show anybody my rough drafts. I don't like anybody to see the process. And I think that it can be applied to my writing, but also just sort of to life. Mm-hmm. I switched schools for high school and I decided I was going to go by a new name, by Allie instead of Alexandra. And, there's this urge to start again and have this radical reinvention. But you don't want anyone to see the process. You sort of want it to be like that. Mm-hmm. And I think there's something pleasurable about being in the dark while that happens and being in the dark to sort of figure out who you want to be.
Yeah. So you live in New York City now. Did you ever think about living in a sleepy little town? Was this a little bit of, oh my gosh, I could just be there. Go get the fish store, go to the cheese store.
In my head, I think I could do it. And then I go to the country and I can't stand it for 2 hours. I mean, I was raised in the city. I'm a real city gal. I like nature, but you know, I always, when I go to my coffee shop in the morning.
Yeah, that's exactly. So even the last year didn't undo you. It didn't sit there and say, let's run for the burp. No.
No, we doubled down. We bought a place in the city.
See, it's like they had the opposite effect of what's going on. You know, Maude has no social media footprint and neither do you. And I really, it's interesting that at a time where I feel like authors are like me all over the place, to not have that deliberate on your part.
Well, you know, somebody else mentioned this and I always felt like I had a normal amount of, I'm on Instagram, you know, which is the one thing I do. And I still feel like I do spend too much time on it. I wish I spent less time on it. But Yeah, Twitter makes me a little nervous. I feel like I can get very confrontational. I don't want to get involved with any of that.
Right.
Instagram I enjoy. I think there's a part of me that wants some walls. I don't want complete strangers looking at pictures of my children. I can't totally articulate why, but it makes me feel a little exposed.
Well, I think that so many people right now, their children's lives are so public, like they do something or whatever, that you may regret that later on.
Or they may resent it, yeah.
They're going to regret later on that you took a picture of them. And some of them could be all but YouTube stars because they're out there that much. But it's like, what do you really want to share? But, and it's interesting to me too, because everybody does edited versions of their life. Like if we make a bad looking dinner, it doesn't get a picture. Like, right. Let's get real. Yeah. Only the great looking ones do.
Yeah.
And I actually put up this Chinese meal I made the other night. And I'm telling you right now, it looked horrible. And I said, it's really tasting good, but I felt like I had to apologize for the way it looked.
Right.
Yeah. So we have this whole thing that we're doing, you know, blah, blah, blah. So when Florence meets Maud, and we're not going to talk about really how they came together, but when Florence meets Maud, which ends up happening, she uses her for self-improvement. And I really like this because she starts looking at what Maud does, what she wears, and she can't afford that brand. So she gets another one, but she's actually studying like the school of Maud of this is what I'm going to be like. How much fun was it writing that? Like who you're going to be, make me like her.
Yeah, it's like those movie montage, you know, the makeover montage. I always love those. I think Florence is somebody who really wants a mentor and a model, and she's never had that. And then, she's trying very hard to figure out who she is, but she has no pattern to follow. And she's sort of just like drifting. And I think she feels a real sense of relief and excitement when she finds someone she actually respects. I would say she's a pretty harsh judge of character. It was fun because I was writing this book about somebody in the early 20s while I was in my mid 30s. And so, you know, it was sort of like I could play both roles. I remember so well what it's like to be figuring out who you want to be, who you want to emulate. And I mean, really seeing these, looking at these women with such envy, but like envy is sort of the engine that makes you become, that makes you ambitious, that makes you change, you know, stop being a child, I suppose. And then I also had the perspective of being 35, where much more comfortable with who I am. And, you know, I've got my opinions and, you know, I'll tell them to you if you want to hear them. And, you know, there's a little bit more of Maud in me there. So the most fun I had while writing this book was writing their dialogue. And it almost felt like, you know, this me now who's a bit tougher and a bit more cynical, talking to the me then who was a bit more nervous and wide-eyed and, you know, changeable.
Stars in your eyes. My career can go any place. And then you sit there and go, it's not really going to, but we're not going to tell you that right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, nobody tells you. They tell you can do anything, but that is not the truth.
No, it's really not the truth. It was funny because when I worked at Mademoiselle magazine, we used to travel the country and do makeovers on people, literally. Like we'd be in like North Dakota doing makeovers on people. And at one point somebody said to me, what do you think the problem is with the magazine? I said, oh, it's really clear. It's what we think is happening in the country. It's what's really happening in the country and what the advertisers think are happening in the country. And they're three completely different things if you go and travel around the country. And I think that that's something that you're really thinking of is both these people did not come from New York. They both came from different places and came into the city with this idea of what you're supposed to do when you get there and then realize, is there really a prescription?
Right, yeah.
It's like, you know, that was going on. Also, Maud says that all stories have to have some basis in reality. Otherwise, it won't feel authentic. But of course, reality is malleable. Great line, one of many, but especially applicable here. So let's talk about that line because it's like reality. What is reality? Not real sure.
I just started the new Ishiguro last night, and I was telling my husband how it draws you in with its sort of unreality. It's like that uncanny valley where it feels so close to reality. And then you just get these little tweaks and you're like, wait, what are you talking about? What's happening here? Yeah. And I think you know, I think anyone who's writing needs to have some basic understanding of human relations, human emotions, because you're not gonna, you know, pull in a reader without that. I think they need to recognize something in the book. But beyond that, I mean, you can make anything happen. That's what's so fun about it. There are no rules, whereas reality can feel very frustratingly rule-bound.
Yeah, yeah. And actually the book's tagline is so perfect of how far would you go to claim the life you always wanted? And you've got two people who both are doing that. They're both going as far as they can go to get the life they wanted. And then they meet each other. And that's always gets really interesting. So dialogue's the one thing I really liked about the book, the snappy dialogue back and forth. Did you have that nailed right from the beginning or did you amp it up?
I think I had it from the beginning. Actually, the first draft was a bit more campy. It was very like, I don't know. I don't know. Farther removed from reality. And I always wanted that that dialogue to feel very like Preston Sturges, like boom, boom, boom. It's just fun to write, and I hope it's fun to read.
Well, do you know what I was thinking too? Is I saw that you wrote copy for Barney's for years. Like you wrote that fashion copy. And I feel like there's a line between like the two of them because it's very aspirational at that point. Yeah. It's very like you want this coat and why you want this coat.
You need this $12,000 dress. Yeah.
Exactly. And you have to have this $12,000 dress because you feel like it's going to solve everything in your life by getting this because the copy is written so much that it's like reeling you in completely until you look at the number and your checkbook and you realize they're not going to come.
There was a part of me that like would actually feel a little bit like icky about what I was doing because I just, you know, I know that people don't need, you know, another $6,000 jacket, but
well, especially these days because I'm sitting there going, what is luxury right now? Like what if luxury is leaving the house?
Childcare, yeah.
Luxury's leaving the house, eating out in a restaurant again indoors. A friend of mine was saying a hug. Yeah. A friend said the other night they went out with some friends and they said, let's eat outside. And she's just there like, okay, let me just go over this. I'm sitting in the suburbs in my winter coat with my sweaters on underneath. And this is supposed to be fun. And she says, well, yes, because we're close to the heater. And she's like, I would never eat in my backyard. I'd never say, let's go out in the backyard and eat in the dead of winter. But now that's something we're aspiring to do.
I mean, I had New Year's Eve dinner outside. I thought it was, I really like it. I hope year-round alfresco dining is here to stay.
Yeah. And I have a funny feeling that might happen. I think that there are people that are saying, oh, this will be really great. There's so many streets. Remember, it was a couple of years ago, how many streets were converted to pedestrian areas and stuff like that. And now, like, you know, what's going to happen? So there's a moment, though, where Florence is very easily able to slip into Maud's world. Very easy access on the back end with these computers of you can take on somebody else's identity pretty quickly. And you had me really wondering, do we have everything locked down here enough? You know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Did something spur the idea of, oh, somebody could really get your stuff pretty quickly?
Well, actually, I was writing this book while I lived in Paris. And one night while we were sleeping, our apartment got robbed and our computers got taken. And I just realized, you know, I'm logged into my email. You can go to any account and say, change my password. And they just send a link to your email and there you go. I mean, and I never close my email. I never log out of my email. I mean, it's just sort of the portal to everything. And I realized how exposed I was. That sort of made me realize that a personal assistant, they really have everything. I mean, that's their job to be you for the boring parts of life.
Yeah, it's like, you want to go buy this online? Here's, it's all set up. It's all, you can just go do anything that you need to do.
You know, I was a personal assistant briefly. And I was getting, you know, I had the credit card and I was, you know, she would send me to buy these $600 gifts at Burger Goodman. And it was so fun. It's so fun to like be that person for 9 hours.
Yeah, it's like, oh, just take the black car and go over here and get this and get that and bring it all back. Yeah, it's...
And you can convince yourself that it's really, you know, it's really you walking into the store with your credit card. And
right. And they treat you differently when you sit there and buy that much stuff.
Totally, yes.
It's like everybody's like, oh, would you like this? Oh, yes, maybe I would. No, that's not authorized. You know? That sounds completely good. Your characters morph so cleverly. And did you see them and what you were going to do right from the start? Or were you playing around with them a little bit more?
You know, I wouldn't say I was playing with the characters so much, but the plot did go through a lot of changes. Mm-hmm. I wrote, I think I had 24 drafts of this novel by the end of it.
Wow.
And yeah, the plot was a bit different. There was not as much Maud actually in the original plot. And then I just had so much fun writing her that I kept having to create opportunities for her to stick around. So yeah, I would say the characters I sort of had, but then I was having such fun, like having them play with each other, that the plot sort of changed to channel their interaction.
Yeah, and they both are playing games. Let's just say they both play games quite well, you know, and to set that. So did you outline in advance? Like, did you have one of these walls where everything was all created in advance, or did you just go?
I tried to outline and then I didn't use it. So, and I'm now in the process of writing my second book. And I'm like, this time it's going to be so much easier if I outline. And I think I'm just somebody who needs to write and figure it out, which is very frustrating because you end up throwing out whole chapters, but I need the voices in my head, and it's very hard for me to like do it very like rationally and dryly. And
I think that what happens too is you start to see something happen, and then you have to say, well, wait a second, how do they get to that point? Like, what, wait, we can invent a much better way for them to get to the point that will confuse the reader even more than they already are.
Yeah.
You know? Like, who is Maud? So why was Morocco their destination? Have you been there? Because Maud is, with just a little backtrack, Maud is writing her second book. She's had this very successful book, Mississippi Foxtrot, which I thought was like a great funny title too. She's written Mississippi Foxtrot. That's the hot book, everybody. And now she's writing her second book. It's going to be partially set in Morocco. So they head off there. Like, why Morocco?
You know, it probably won't come as a huge surprise to hear that I was very inspired by Patricia Highsmith while I was writing this. And she always has wonderful, wonderful settings. So I wanted to do some place that felt very, you know, aspirational in one sense, and also very different from where they both come from and where the first half of the book takes place. I think when you're in these, your settings are totally different. You yourself become a bit more changeable. And I wanted to go there to research it, which I did. This was while I was living in Paris. And I mean, it's a 2-hour flight. It's so close. And it's just, it feels so different. And I mean, really lovely. I wish I had been able to stay for longer. I can't wait to get back.
Yeah. So I tell you, this is the year where international travel has been going to the food section, the international food section at the grocery store. So I love the exoticness of it. So from my couch, I felt like I was beamed into Morocco, and you really captured the place, the smells, the bazaars, the marketplace, and the remoteness as well. Mm-hmm. And how, if you're somebody who's come there from this country and you don't really know your way around or what's happening, you could get yourself in a lot of trouble pretty quickly. You know, and I think that that was really, really good. So I think I read that you had a baby last March, like, you know, like kick off the pandemic with a baby.
Yeah, and I was born at the exact moment that New York shut down. I mean, to the minute.
Always a very iconic birthday going forward. And you have another young child too, which made it even more challenging. Was the book done before we went into lockdown, or did you get to rewrite?
It was mostly done. I did not have major edits to do. I had like copy edits to do, and you know, it was all sort of laid out, and I was going through changing a few things, which was difficult. You know, my husband was working. I mean, he did take some paternity leave, but he was working full time, you know, no childcare, toddler, baby. It was a difficult few months, but I think it was difficult for everyone. So I don't wanna.
Yeah, you were home with the baby, but guess what? So was everyone else. Everyone else was home. They just did have the baby there too. You know? Was this always the title of the book? Who is Maud Dixon? Like, was that?
No, we've actually went through many, many iterations. When I first wrote it, it was A Sharper Shadow, which nobody liked except for me. And I think it's actually, now I realize it's very hard to say. It's a bit like real juror from 30 Rock. But yeah, I went through a few iterations, but I do like the one we ended up with. I hope it feels intriguing and specific.
Well, it's intriguing also with the question mark right on the front screen, because from the cover, because you're just looking right away and like, wait a second, who is? And that line going down the middle, you're sitting there like, okay, what does that mean? Like, you know.
I know, like, the cover designer did such a great job.
Was this the first cover? Did they go through a couple of iterations?
The second cover. The first one was, it was similar. It was a bit like a bit darker in tone. And I wanted, I was trying, you know, this isn't one of those thrillers where it's like very grim and seedy. And I wanted sort of to communicate a sense of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I really like is that's what I'm seeing in it, but I'm also seeing this big question mark. I mean, it leaps out at you of who is it? And like, what are you going to do from there? I don't know. Boy, when you get to know her, oh my gosh. But it's this book that you're going to really want to talk about as soon as you finish reading it. You're going to want to talk about it with people. I say it'd be great for book groups because it's got that publishing side of the story to it on so many different levels. It's the aspirational, I'm working there, because people always like stories of inside publishing. I think there are 3 books coming out this year of people working in publishing.
Oh, really?
Authors in publishing. Yeah, it's like really crazy. But then also Therese Plummer, does a really great job of narrating. Did you pick her for this?
I mean, they sent me one option and I said, she's fantastic. So I didn't really pick her, but I okayed her or I thumbs up her.
No, it was really, really, really great. And Universal Pictures has already picked up the film, like the film rights. Are you involved in that at all?
I mean, I've had some conversations. Yeah, I've had conversations with the writer director and with some of the producers. I think, you know, we all have the same idea for what we hope this movie can be. And yeah, I mean, I'm not doing the script. That's just out of my wheelhouse. But
but you know, you write cinematically. You really write cinematically. Like, I could see that they could pick this up and go to script from here because the writing is just so strong and it's, you know, really, really terrific. So did you, are you working on something now? Like, how far along are you? Like, we're going to see in a year, 2 years, or like, good luck, Carol, you know?
Oh, Lord. I am working on something. I am finding it very difficult. I don't know if it's the old second book problem or the old pandemic problem or both of them, but I'm getting there. And it feels similar to Who is Maude Dixon in a lot of ways. I think I'm just interested in certain themes and I will continue to explore those until I run out of things to say.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Most of the authors that I've talked to this year said this is the hardest year they've ever had to write.
Oh, that makes me feel so much better.
Oh, no. Many, many, many have said to me, we've had a really hard time writing this year, sitting down and getting out of your own head because there's so much going on. I mean, when you really think back on over the last year of all the things that have happened and like, it's just been like 10 years. Like there's times I sit there and I go, really, was that just really a year ago? And I think when we hit the anniversary, which would have been your son's birthday in March, by the time we hit the birthday, it's like, oh my God, we're still doing this. Like, how can we still be doing this? And I think that it's taken a toll on people because let's face it, what you're living right now, you couldn't write in a book. Like you couldn't have figured out that everybody be like, if I say that if an author showed up, if you walked into your editor's office and say, I've got this idea. Okay, there's going to be something that's going to happen. Everybody's going to be home. The children aren't going to go to school. We're not going to go out to eat. We're not going to see anybody. We're going to wear masks. And you just like go down the whole list. They'd say, oh no, cut back 50% and maybe we can talk, right? Yeah. And instead we had the whole thing. So I think we were living the novel. we were living the novel for the last year, you know? So I think that the readers enjoy and remember, you know, all she wanted was a different life. Like there was this great line, like right inside the book is all she ever wanted was a different life. And when you finish reading, you're going to think that's applicable. That's a whole book group discussion, just that line of all she wanted was a different life. And the question as you finish reading the book is who wanted a different life? And you can play with that too. So, mm-hmm. I congratulate you because you had me going like right from the beginning and you kept me right through to the end. And there are readers where we can't give anything away. Someday I want to have you on in a year where we can actually have people talked about it and we can go in depth more. But I think it's just such a treat. And I congratulate you because it was a big feat to pull off for a debut novel.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. That's good. Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us today. We look forward to seeing
such fun.
What you get back next. We're like ready to hear. And to our readers, thanks you for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Keep listening for an audio excerpt from Who is Maude Dixon, narrated by Therese Plummer, coming up after the credits, courtesy of Hachette Audio. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue. Thanks to our research assistant, Sam Johnson. And now, hear an audio excerpt from Who is Maude Dixon, courtesy of Hachette Audio.
Semat, Morocco. Madame Wheelcock? Her left eyelid wrenched open and warm yellow light flooded into the crack. Her vision was crossed by a blurred figure in white. She shut her eye. Madame Wheelcock? A shrill beeping sounded from somewhere. She forced both eyes open this time. She was lying in uncomfortable bed, flanked by two dirty curtains. Madame Wheelcock? She turned her head stiffly. A man in what looked like a military uniform sat in a chair pulled up to the bed, leaning forward onto his thighs and watching her intently. His face had the puffed plastic curves of a baby doll. He was not smiling. Madame Wheelcock, he said for the fourth time. Helen? She asked in a patchy voice. Helen, he nodded. Do you know where you are? She looked around. Hospital? That's right. You had the big night.
The big night?
The very big night. She let out a small, involuntary laugh. The man frowned, visibly annoyed. Then the curtain on her left swished open. They both turned their heads. A woman in a white headscarf and white jacket stepped through. A nurse? She leaned over the bed and smiled warmly. She said something in a foreign language and smoothed out the thin blanket. Then she turned to the man at the bedside and said something to him in a sharper tone. He stood up, holding out his palms in appeasement. He smiled coldly and pushed the curtain aside. He was gone. The young woman in the bed turned to the nurse, but she, too, was leaving.
Wait,
she called hoarsely. The nurse either didn't hear her or didn't heed her. She was alone. Her gaze settled on the ceiling. It was mottled with brown water spots. She tried to push herself up to a sitting position, but found herself hindered by a cast on her left wrist. That's when she noticed that she was in pain, everywhere. She looked back at the empty chair the man had sat in. He had called her Madame Wheelcock. The information seemed significant, but she couldn't place it within any meaningful context. She shut her eyes again. A few moments later, or perhaps it had been hours, the curtain opened again. The nurse had returned with a different man. Madame Wheelcock, he said, I am glad you are awake. He spoke English with more precision than most native speakers, each syllable demarcated crisply from the next. I am Dr. Tazi. I was on call when you arrived last night with two fractured ribs, a broken wrist, and hematomas across your face and torso. I was told you had been in a car accident. We often see injuries like these caused by airbags. You are lucky they are not worse. The nurse, as if waiting for her cue, presented a Dixie cup of water and a white pill the size of a molar. Hydrocodone. For the pain, the doctor said. I will return this afternoon to assess your condition, but I do not foresee any reason to keep you past tomorrow. Until then, you should rest, Madame Wheelcock. He left, trailing the white-robed nurse behind him like a veil.
Madame Wilcox. She mouthed the name silently. Helen. Then the light withdrew and sleep descended. Two young women climbed a narrow set of stairs toward the sound of laughter and music. Florence Darrow, in front, dragged her hand along the blood-red wall. "There's something perverse about throwing publishing parties here," she said. Both women worked as editorial assistants at Forrester Books, and tonight was the office holiday party, held every year on the second floor of a dark bar called The Library, where the theme was literary kitsch. "It's like having a United Nations summit at Epcot." "Totally," agreed Lucy Gund in a small voice. Her dress had hitched up on her tights during the climb, and now it was bunched around her thighs. They reached the top of the stairs and stepped in to survey the scene. The party had started only half an hour earlier, but already a noisy din rose from the crowd and hung above it like smog. Nearly 100 people, some who worked with them, many who didn't, clustered in tightly packed groups. Florence hadn't wanted to get there too early, but she wished they had arrived in time to stake out a corner for themselves. The girls scanned the room, looking for familiar and approachable faces. They found none. "Drink first?" Florence suggested. Lucy nodded. The two women had started at Forrester at the same time, nearly 2 years ago, and Lucy had immediately granted Florence her unconditional loyalty. On paper, Lucy was just the type of friend Florence had hoped to make in New York. Lucy had grown up in Amherst, where both her parents taught in the college's English department. Her father had written the definitive biography of Nathaniel Hawthorne. Florence had spent her first Thanksgiving with them after moving to the city. She'd been delighted to find that their old, book-filled house lay just down the road from Emily Dickinson's. It was the type of intellectual idol Florence had always wished she'd grown up in herself. It was everything her mother's cramped apartment in Port Orange was not. In practice, however, Lucy lacked the confident sophistication that Florence assumed would be the natural inheritance of a childhood like that. She was painstakingly shy, and Florence sometimes suspected that Lucy's mother had told her to find just one friend in New York and she'd be fine. Florence had been the first person Lucy met at Forrester. They had never really been incorporated into the company's larger social scene, mainly because Lucy hadn't tried and Florence hadn't succeeded. Since Florence had also cut off contact with her old friends from Florida, she thought of her past as a gangrenous limb that needed to be severed for the greater good. Lucy was, for all intents and purposes, her only friend. They wormed their way through the crowd, past a long table piled with grapes and cheeses, toward an imposing mahogany bar in the back. A bartender in a black satin vest smiled at some point just above their heads. They did not, apparently, meet the qualifications for his undivided attention. Lucy was used to being overlooked, in fact, seemed to prefer it. But Florence had had just enough success with men to be disappointed when her charms went unnoticed. Florence was not unattractive, but without exception, the first thing anyone noticed about her was her pallor. She looked like someone who had grown up in a bunker rather than the Florida sunshine. Evidence that she had been born in the wrong place, she often thought with satisfaction. Her fair skin flushed easily, whether with shyness or fervor was never quite clear, as if her creator had been torn between the competing impulses of purity and perversion. Some men found this effect entrancing, but many were put off. She also had dark, nearly black eyes and dirty blonde curls that sprang from her head like Medusa's. Despite the hundreds of dollars her mother had spent over the years on gels, sprays, and holding creams, Florence still had not learned how to tame them. "What'll it be, ladies?" the bartender asked in a practiced tone. The light glinted off the stiffened spikes of his hair. Florence imagined crunching them under her fingers like frost-covered grass. Lucy pointed to a placard advertising the specialty cocktail. "I'll try the Dewar's Decimal System, I guess."
Florence ordered a red wine.
I've got Cabernet or Pinot.
Either, she said in a tone she hoped sounded breezy. She knew nothing about wine. They each took a sip, then set off to find a group with breachable borders. They spotted some other assistants huddled by the food table and joined the fringes. A junior editor named Amanda Lincoln was arguing showily with a tall, lanky 20-something in a tan corduroy suit.
There's literally no way, you fucking misogynist, Amanda said.
Gretchen, a perky assistant whose desk faced Florence's, turned to explain, Fritz claims he knows for a fact that Maud Dixon is a man.
No,
whispered Lucy, drawing her hand up to her mouth. Maud Dixon was the pen name of a writer who'd published a spectacularly successful debut novel a couple of years earlier called Mississippi Foxtrot. It was about two teenage girls, Maud and Ruby, desperate to escape their tiny hometown of Collier Springs, Mississippi. They are thwarted at every turn by their age, their gender, their poverty, and the cold indifference of their families. Everything comes to a head when Maud kills a contractor traveling through town on his way to a job in Memphis. He had made the mistake of setting his sights on 16-year-old Ruby and refusing to look away. The murder ultimately releases both girls from the clutches of their hometown. One ends up in prison. The other lands a scholarship to Ole Miss. Critics had remarked upon the sharp, unsentimental prose and the freshness of the perspective, which caught the attention of the literary crowd. But the book didn't really take off until a famous Hollywood actress chose it for her book club. Whether by prescience or by luck, the novel had appeared at the height of the hashtag MeToo movement and perfectly captured the strain of righteous, brutal anger in the air. Whatever happened the night young Maud Dixon stabbed Frank Dillard, an undeniably menacing, lecherous figure, behind the Driftwood Tavern, you couldn't quite bring yourself to blame her for it. The book had sold more than 3 million copies in the U.S. alone, and there was a miniseries in production. Curiously, its author, Maud Dixon, was a cipher. She did no interviews, no book tours, no publicity whatsoever. There wasn't even an acknowledgments page in the book. The novel's publishing house, one of Forrester's competitors, admitted that Maud Dixon was a pen name and that the author preferred to remain anonymous. Naturally, this set off immediate and rampant speculation about her identity. Who is Maud Dixon? Was the question asked in countless magazine articles, online forums, and publishing lunches all over town. The two known Maud Dixons in America had been duly tracked down and ruled out. One lived in a nursing home in Chicago and couldn't remember the names of her own children. The other was a dental hygienist who'd grown up in a middle-class town on Long Island, and by all accounts had never shown any talent for or proclivity toward writing. Many people assumed the story was autobiographical, since the author and the narrator shared a name. A few amateur sleuths had identified crimes that shared certain markers with the one in the book, but none matched closely enough to be a smoking gun. Besides, Mississippi sealed the court records of juvenile offenders when they turned 20. The town of Collier Springs didn't even exist. The investigation stalled there. In general, Florence tended to look down on books that owed their success to the dramatic machinations of plot. Murder, in her eyes, was cheap currency. But when she'd read Mississippi Foxtrot, she'd been astounded. The murder wasn't a technical ploy to up the stakes. It was the novel's raison d'être. The reader could feel the author's urgency, the murderer's absolute imperative, even the satisfaction of the knife going in. Florence could still recite the passage. The knife slipped in easily, a sharp-edged interloper among the warm, feminine folds of Frank's insides. She raised the knife again. This time it hit a rib and shuddered violently. Her hand slipped off the handle and slapped the soft, pale flesh. His stomach was coated in blood now, the coarse, dark hair slicked down like a newborn scalp. The voice was like nothing Florence had ever read before, sharp and savage, almost violent. Ultimately, she didn't care whether Maud Dixon was a man or a woman. She knew that whoever she was,
She was an outsider, like Florence herself. "Why are you getting so worked up about this?" Fritz asked Amanda. "Jesus, I'm not saying women can't write. I'm just saying that this particular writer is not a woman." Amanda pinched the bridge of her nose and took a deep breath. "Why am I getting so worked up? Because this particular writer was the best-selling novelist of the year, and she was nominated for the National Book Award. But of course, it can only be an important book if a man wrote it. If a woman wrote it, it's just book club drivel. For God's sake, you can't have all the fucking cookies and then come take our crumbs, too." Technically, Florence interjected. James Patterson was the best-selling author that year, even though Mississippi Foxtrot was the best-selling book. The group turned to look at her in one synchronized motion. "I think," she added, though she was sure, and immediately hated herself for it. "Well, thank you, Florence. There goes another crumb." "This isn't about whatever absurd scorecard you keep in your back pocket, Amanda," said Fritz. "My friend, who happens to be a woman, by the way, works at Frost Bolin and swore to me that Maud Dixon is a man. She could be a woman, obviously, but she happens not to be in this case." He shrugged in apology. Frost Bolin was Maud Dixon's literary agency. "So who is it then?" Amanda demanded. "What's his name?" Here, Fritz faltered. I don't know. She just overheard him referred to as a he." Amanda threw up her hands. "Ugh, this is total bullshit. There's literally no way a man could have written that book. There's not a man on earth who can write women that convincingly, no matter how well he may convince himself." As if to punish herself for her earlier timidity, Florence said, "Henry James? E.M. Forster? William Thackeray?" She'd always felt a special affinity with Becky Sharp. Amanda turned to face her. "Seriously, Florence? You think Mississippi Foxtrot could have been written by a man?" Florence shrugged. "Maybe. I don't see what difference it would make." Amanda looked at the ceiling and said in wonder, "She doesn't see what difference it would make." She turned back and asked, "Are you a writer, Florence?" "No," Florence said quietly. In fact, she wanted nothing more than to be a writer. Didn't they all? Every one of them probably had half a novel tucked away in some drawer. But you don't go around calling yourself a writer until it's out of the drawer. "Well, then it may be hard for you to fully appreciate how important it is for female writers to have female exemplars. Women who have come before them and refuse to let their inner lives be explained by men. I don't need one more man telling me how women are, okay? Can you understand that?" Florence performed some motion between a shrug and a nod. "Unhappy, the land in need of heroes," Amanda added. Florence said nothing. "Brecht?" Amanda prodded, raising her eyebrows. Florence felt heat rushing to her face, and she turned her body instinctively away from the group to hide it. She downed the rest of her drink in a single gulp and walked back to the bar, where she raised her empty glass in the bartender's direction with a tight smile. She leaned against the wood and lifted her sore feet out of her heels one by one. She had never liked girls with Amanda's easy confidence. They were the same girls in high school who had taken Florence under their wing for a week and paraded her around like a rescue dog before losing interest in the game. Florence knew that to them, she was nothing more than a prop to be used in their performances. And if she didn't cooperate by playing the grateful protege, they had no use for her. It was such a fatuous routine, too. That was what annoyed Florence the most. Amanda, who had grown up on the Upper West Side, wore her feminism the same way she'd probably once worn her private school uniform. Casually, without thinking too much about it, but committedly. Florence had never been able to reach the pitch of outrage the time seemed to require. And this immunity to communal indignation often left her on the outside of, well, everything. This outrage seemed to be the glue that held everyone else together. Couples, friends, the target audience of most media conglomerates. Even the young petition hawkers on the street ignored Florence, as if they could sense her innate solipsism. She wasn't placid, certainly not, but she reserved her anger for more personal uses.
though what these were, she couldn't say precisely. She could be as surprised as anyone by her flights of rage. They were rare, disorienting experiences that left her feeling weak and confused, almost jet-lagged, as if her body had raced ahead without her and she was just catching up. Once, in a creative writing seminar in college, Florence's professor had ripped into one of her stories in front of everyone, calling it dull and derivative. After class, Florence had mounted an increasingly hysterical defense of her work and then moved into a personal attack on him, a second-rate author who'd only ever published a single overlooked book of short stories. When she finally lost steam, the teacher was staring at her with what could only be described as horror. Florence could barely remember what she'd said. After the bartender finally took notice of Florence's empty glass, a voice behind her startled her.
"I'm with you."
She turned around. It was Simon Reed, Forrester's editorial director, a tall, thin man with floppy hair, delicate features, and a smattering of freckles across his face. He was considered handsome in this milieu, but Florence could only imagine what they would say about him back in Port Orange, where delicate features weren't exactly an asset on a man. Florence turned to face him.
"In what sense?" "In the sense of who fucking cares who Maud Dixon is."
The words dribbled from his mouth like soup. He was drunk, she realized.
"It wouldn't change the words on the page,"
he went on.
"Or rather, for some people it would, but it shouldn't. Ezra Pound was a fascist, but he still wrote some beautiful fucking sentences."
"The ant's a centaur in his dragon world," Florence said.
"Pull down thy vanity. I say pull down," said Simon, nodding.
They shared a silent smile of complicity. She caught sight of Amanda watching them, but Amanda's eyes darted away when she saw Florence notice. The bartender set Florence's fresh glass of wine on the counter. When she picked it up, Simon tapped his own glass against it and leaned in close.
"To anonymity,"
he said quietly.